Welcome to the 10th episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. I'm the co-founder of Reckless Dice and your host, Paul Rorschach-Tobia. With me tonight on the regular crew is co-founder Jesse Gitzman-Burke.
Good evening.
And we've also got Lester Crow and his strolling bones.
Hello.
And Dan, who's soon to be getting a new handle, Carrick.
Siempre si uno diez, diez, diez.
And we've hamming it up already. And we've also got a special guest this episode. We're super excited to have him on here. Mark Dice Monkey Meredith. You may know him from his own website, Dice Monkey, and also he's a participant in another RPG podcast out there, the RPG Circus.
How's it going?
Mark.
Thanks.
Welcome
very much. So I know I kind of talked a little bit about Dice Monkey and RPG Circus, but if you just give the folks over here who haven't maybe heard of you or heard of your other work, kind of what you're doing with those other projects.
Yeah, over on Dice Monkey, that's a blog that's about almost three or four years old by now. I've been running that. Me and my wife write for that. Lately, just me because my wife's been great with child, so she hasn't been participating too much in role-playing games. But I talk about pretty much everything on there, any role-playing game that's currently amusing me. I have a lot of readers who their interest wanes with me when I'm not discussing a game that they're interested in.
And recently you guys have been doing a lot of Warhammer.
Yeah. I've got a new group, so we've been playing a lot of Warhammer. And with that, I've been discussing the different topics and stuff that we've got that you guys have been talking about, party sheets and how the dice work and things like that. So I've had a really good time with that. And then I also have got RPG Circus, which is the greatest show in gaming, as we call it. And that is usually three hosts, so we have three rings for the circus, and each of us comes with a separate topic. With that, we're able to talk about all different kinds of subjects, and the other two guys are usually a bit more old school grognardy. They spend a lot of time criticizing Warhammer Fantasy until I
grognarding
sort of set them straight. Yeah,
I like that term. We always call them beardy gamers, but
grognarding. Use that as a handle for me, okay? No grognarding.
So we will rattle off the roster of Dan's failed handle attempts, and grognard would have been a good one.
Excellent.
To go back to that, though, Mark, I mean, that is one of the reasons why we kind of got together and started the Reckless Dice Podcast, is because there was so much misconception or misunderstanding about what Warhammer was, just being so imposing with the big box set, and it's from Fantasy Flight and all that. But us on the crew, we actually got into it and played it and realized, hey, this is a pretty damn good role playing game. Why aren't more people talking about it? So that's kind of where we came from. So,
and actually, I came across Dice Monkey when researching our own podcast and trying to do some analytics and things like that, and came across several of the articles that that Mark had written, and that's where I kind of got introduced to his blog and the stuff him and his wife have been working on, and have been checking it out since then. You guys do some good stuff.
Thanks.
That also introduced me to RPG Circus, which was nice.
Good.
Yeah, it's a great general reference. You guys cover it all, which is very cool.
Yeah, we try to.
So let's get going. Here we are, episode 10. We're in double digits, so we've been here for roughly 20 weeks, providing you information about Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition, and we haven't run out of ideas yet, so hopefully we'll be around for a lot more. But we want to thank all our listeners, and I'd like to thank you guys on the crew very much for participating and joining in. So thanks, everyone.
Absolutely. Thank you, everybody.
Yes, thank you.
I have my celebratory rum and coke in hand.
You're an alcoholic, Jesse. You need to stop. Yep, there you go.
They're clinky, clinky.
Clinky, clink.
All right, so let's get into the rest of the news. So it was kind of a regular thing that we did, talking about Omens of War and the speculation around that. Then Omens of War actually came out, so now we got a whole new cycle of speculation with Blackfyre Pass and what Fantasy Flight has put out their first release of a little look into what Blackfyre Pass is going to contain. So what do you guys think?
I'm really excited.
Overly joyed.
There's girl dwarfs.
There is a girl dwarf.
Definitely. Yeah.
Well, actually, girl dwarfs are very highly respected, and there are more female dwarfs on the, like, Grand Council than there are male dwarfs. So says the, what's it called? It's like Stone and Steel or whatever. It's a first edition book about dwarves.
Oh, okay.
So I thought that they didn't really exist, but apparently they do.
You know, it's something that every RPG alludes to, that dwarf females exist, but you almost never see a picture of them. And here we actually have a picture of a female, you know, Warhammer dwarf, which prior to this I'd only seen in the online Age of Reckoning game.
She doesn't have a beard.
That's right, she doesn't. She does have that very Helga look with the winged helm and the braids and the giant breastplate boob cup things.
Mm-hmm. Boob cups things.
That's a technical term.
How many Roman Cokes have you had so far?
I know. Jesse on six.
Huh? I started this morning.
She's got the boob.
It's called a breastplate, Jesse.
Thank you.
I like boobies. Called the breastplates.
So they've talked about, they've kind of teased some of the rules for runesmithing, dwarf engineering, 10 new careers. Looks like they're going to be talking about orcs too.
Yeah, I think if they continue this kind of paired aspect of all the books and supplements they've added so far, I mean, obviously we're seeing dwarves, but the Blackfyre Pass is famous for the dwarf and orc battles, and that also includes goblins, so kind of greenskins as a whole. I think for certain, if the creature card in the promo here has a greenskin night goblin, and it's actually Zurgash's followers, so that must be Zurgash is probably going to be one of the main enemy NPCs in the adventure. So we'll certainly see night goblins. That's a bonus.
Yeah, night goblins are awesome.
So that means maybe we're going to get more squigs. We'll probably get fanatics. I'm sure we'll get fanatics. We'll definitely get some orcs, some black orcs.
That was the one thing I disliked about your goblin army, Jesse, was all your fanatics.
I did make a fanatic.
And your squigs.
Yes.
And your squigs.
I hope we get more squigs. That'd be great.
Hopefully there's some mushroom hallucinogenics in there, too.
The madcap mushrooms. I think for certain we'll see those if there's a night goblin focus.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That'll be awesome.
And did anybody else notice the action cards down here for this? I think it was a Slayer. And it had the conservative side to "This Will Be Glorious Death." And says, "What are you doing in conservative stance, you pansy?"
Yeah, there aren't even any rules for it.
Yeah. Cannot be used.
Good stuff. So what we're expecting is that they'll be coming out basically every other week with that up until release. And, you know, if they're following the same pattern as they did with Omens of War, which I thought was great. You know, they keep the interest going. They give you some actual substantive content of it. And it's really, if you take the time to go through all the previews, you know what you're getting when you go and buy the box, because unlike a book that you can leaf through, you know, if you open up the box and start ripping out bits, your friendly local gaming store usually frowns on that. So
yeah.
Cool. So additionally, we've got another update to the Schmottwow there, Jesse.
Yeah, it's not a big update to the map as a whole, but Jacob McQuaid, my partner in crime to get the scripting up and running for the Google Maps version, has helped me upload my most current version, which includes everything up through Omens of War and also a few other additions scattered throughout the map. Those are all now visible in the full screen and in window version of the map.
So I hear, Jesse, after last episode, you replaced my English accent.
I did.
I'm deeply hurt. No, I heard there was another guy on here.
He did. He did a lot better job than you did. Yeah.
Damn it, man! I've been practicing.
He was very authentic.
I think he was born into it, Dan. Don't feel.
I know. I'm not gonna.
It took him years to kind of just grow that accent into what it is today.
Yeah, you should just stick with the Hispanic.
That was actually quite good.
Siempre siendo Diaz, Diaz, Diaz.
That's what happens when you get the Spanish channel.
That's Telemundo, man.
I know, right?
So the other thing that we've got going on, so Jesse, out where you're at, your local con is on this weekend, right? KublaCon?
It is, yeah. KublaCon's finally here, and I'm sorry to hear Dan won't be able to join.
I'm graduating, buddy. I'm walking that day.
You're done. That's
the
right.
Day that you are rolling dice and taking initiative tests, like Lester says, I will be walking across and grabbing a fake piece of paper, which they declare as my diploma.
I will make an education check special for you. You're right. So the in Burlingame, just south of the San Francisco airport, KublaCon is going to be this weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. You guys have heard me mention it several times now, so I'm not going to get too much into it, except that we do have a really healthy group brewing from the Fantasy Flight Forums who are going to be meeting up at the con. I think we've got about 8 to 10 people now, so we'll be able to run two or three games at a time of Warhammer throughout our time there, if anybody's interested in playing. We'll meet up, have some drinks, and have some fun. So anybody who I haven't already contacted who's interested in going, you can hit me up on Twitter at jburkdesign. We'll be using the hashtag KublaConWFRP. And if anybody sees me, I'll have my Reckless Dice shirt on, which is a dark blue shirt. It says Reckless Dice on the back. Pretty hard to miss. I'll wear that on Saturday, the first main day of the convention. So feel free and come say hi.
Thank God he won't wear it for all 3 days.
And just, yeah, really, right? Some people do. And just for kicks, as a fun promotion to see if it works, anybody from the podcast who comes and says hi to me, I'll buy you a drink up at the bar.
Damn, that's a good deal.
If you're over 21.
That's a good deal. I'll just come back with a mustache and I'll be like, hello, Jesse, I'd like a beer, please.
Hello.
Hello.
So that's about it for KublaCon promotion.
Also,
but it should be a lot of fun.
Also, you've got KublaCon, but just to give a heads up, there are two more Bay Area ones coming up in September, which we can touch on later. But there's a CelestaCon and a Conquest, which are two big conventions. CelestaCon's pretty brand new, but Conquest has been around for a while, so we'll kind of touch in on those in September. So
are those both RPG and gaming conventions?
CelestaCon is more RPG gaming. They're trying to adapt with miniatures, but they're more of RPG and card games. Conquest is like Kubla, it's just smaller. Conquest has been around for a while. They have them in there's one in Sacramento, one in Vegas.
Well, that's where I knew it from, because I just missed the one in Sacramento here, and was kind of bummed about that.
Correct. That's the same con that it's in Santa Clara. And then CelestaCon is there. Unfortunately, Jesse, we will have to pick which one we're going to go to in September because they're both on the same day. They're both September 2nd through September 4th. So, okay. But they're pretty cool. I think I'm leaning towards CelestaCon. So
Dan, we've been rumoring that you're going to be getting a new handle. You came to us, the professionals, to ask for help in giving you a new name.
Am I paying for these professional services? Because if I do, I want my money back.
Well, you have already given up your rights to decide your name.
That's right.
And we have taken the initiative and thrown it out onto the interwebs and allowed our fans and friends to help participate in giving you the new name.
So you in friends, you mean Paul Roshak Bubia?
Anybody who is willing to listen, really. And maybe we'll rattle off a few of the fun ones. We had a lot of submissions. I think we had about 20 in all names given to us for Dan something something Carrick, and they ranged from the obscene to the rude to the crude to the funny to the awesome.
Fluffy Nutter. Whoever thought of that one, I need to buy you a beer. Nutter. That's hilarious.
Fluffer Nutter. But
Fluffer Nutter.
Yes. Fluffer Nutter is actually currently the clear winner. Dan Fluffer Nutter Carrick. There are a couple other good ones in here too, like Dan Violently Tender Carrick, Codan the Barbarian.
I love that one.
Dan Vanilla Dice Carrick. So, you know, the Fluffer Nutter.
What if I was going to tell them I'm not white? So what, now they're being racist, they're calling me Vanilla?
Maybe you're just a very average dude.
I know, yeah.
So the Codan the Barbarian and Fluffer Nutter Carrick are the two clear front runners in the battle here, and I thought we would, you've already said that you will abide by whatever the fans and us choose.
Correct.
And so, amongst the, let's cast some final votes with the four of us, who are on the podcast separate from Dan and see where we land. So, Paul, what, Fluffer Nutter or Codan?
I love you, Paul.
I'll go with Codan. I like that. That's a pretty good one.
All right. So, okay. And then, Lester, I know you're a Codan man.
Oh, Codan all the way.
All right, Mark, where are you landing?
I'm going to have to go with Codan.
I think Codan is going to be the unanimous winner then. Fluffernutter, Fluffernutter is your backup name, though. If we're ever wanting to kind of rib you one, you will.
Well, here, how
Fluffernutter's not going anywhere.
This isn't
like Dune, guys. This isn't like, you know, we'll call you Usul, but when we're out in the waste, we'll call you, you know, Muad'Dib.
So we now dub the Codan the Barbarian character.
Yes. I don't have to.
All hail Codan.
Dan, you lucked out, dude.
I lucked out
with probably our listeners' desire to give you a respectable name because of its actual cool factor won out over the desire to embarrass you.
How about this? I will buy a Reckless Dice t-shirt, and I have a guy that does t-shirt designs. I will put Codan and Fluffernutter on the back of them for names. I'll wear tramp stamps. How's that? Fluffernutter the tramp stamp.
Are you going to put it right above your ass on the back?
Yes, I will. Jesse, it's going to have an arrow that says vacancy available.
All right. So
now just kidding, I'm not gay. Okay, I'm sorry.
Now that we've gotten that taken care of, let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll actually do some talking about Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay with Insanity, Corruption, and Disease in our system spotlight. And we're back, and now we're up to the system spotlight part of the podcast, and this time around, we're going to get into some of the unique mechanics around other ways to hurt your players as a GM, or be hurt as a player, than just taking damage. Specifically, we're going to talk about insanity, corruption. Insanity's in quite a few role-playing games. Corruption, which is pretty unique to the Warhammer setting, and then disease as well. So we'll just kind of jump right into things. I think the most basic one, or the one of the more common ones, is the insanity side of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition, and it really kind of gets into the almost Call of Cthulhu aspects of Warhammer, the idea that your mind is not only affected as well as your body. So
I couldn't agree more. I often kind of, when I try and explain Warhammer to somebody who is familiar with role-playing but not the Warhammer system specifically, I'll often compare it to a mix between Call of Cthulhu and D&D or something like that, where you have this really cool combat atmosphere but also this whole mental battle that your characters should be going through at the same time.
And it was, I think that there's a really, really elegant way that they've included insanity into the system. There isn't a separate characteristic for sanity. There isn't a separate tracker like sanity points, like wound points are. It's built into the process around stress and fatigue. So as your character becomes more stressed and fatigued, the higher chance that something snaps. When you're at the end of your rope, when you're just wading through and you just woke up and you had a nice day and stuff like that, that's not when you go insane. When you go insane is when you're at the end of your rope.
Yeah.
Both mentally and physically.
So let's maybe cover quickly what can cause an insanity to be, you know, bestowed upon your character.
Right, so it's when your stress is greater than your lowest mental characteristic. So that's so when you are stressed. So if you have a dump stat like a fellowship of two, once you gain three stress, you're going to be counted as stressed. And then when your fatigue is over your lowest physical characteristic, then of course you're in that fatigue mode. If you're stressed and fatigued at the same time, that counts as a new mode, which is strain. And once you're in strain, once you're in a strained mode, anytime you gain any additional stress or fatigue, you're going to gain a temporary insanity.
As far as I know, it's actually when your willpower is distressed. I think that's what it says right in the insanity thing that I'm looking at right now. It says when a character's willpower is distressed, he is susceptible to the ravages of insanity.
So that's a separate piece. And I apologize. Wasn't clear about that. If your willpower, if your stress is over your willpower, no matter what your fatigue is, you will start taking temporary insanity. So if you've got a willpower of 3, you've got 4 stress but 0 fatigue, you're going to start accumulating temporary insanities. But if you are stressed with anything, willpower or any other stat, and fatigued at the same time, you're in that same susceptibility.
So, Mark, you guys are kind of, you and your group are relatively new to the Warhammer role-playing 3rd edition system. Is that correct?
Yeah. Our group has only gotten together twice for the game so far.
Have you guys experimented much with insanity yet?
We haven't, and I really want to because I've got one of my players really wants to play a Witch Hunter. Hmm. So, and I believe you have to have at least 1 permanent insanity for that too, for you to be able to get that. Okay. So I want to. I'm just trying to figure out at what point how to do it. I'm thinking about introducing Skaven into the game, which, as all the Empire knows, they don't exist. So I think that may be a good way to begin giving us some insanities out.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you could use the Enigma trait to kind of baffle them. They wouldn't believe that they're alive, you know? Because that's one thing about the insanity cards that's really cool is when you draw an insanity card, you draw one until one of the traits match. And each insanity usually has 2 of these 5 traits that they've laid out.
Now, I have a question.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, now, in this game, is there... I know that elves are harder to go insane than humans. Are dwarves the same? Because I know that...
Actually, you're barking up the almost the right tree there. Okay. It's actually the mutations that are certain races are more resilient to. Humans are the most susceptible to insanity, corruption, the whole shebang. But you know, things like dwarves, halflings, high elves, wood elves, they have some inherent resistance to chaos mutations. In the game mechanics, what that translates into is when instead of gaining mutations, they actually take on additional insanities instead. So they're actually, in theory, they just, you know, instead of gaining corruption and insanities, they just, both those trees lead to insanities.
Gotcha.
I think
that the high elves get to choose to be disciplined at character creation. Which would assist you in not becoming insane, because
you have to pass
a discipline check in order to not take on an insane.
And that tends to be a dwarf trait as well. It looks like they kind of build in that mechanic both from physically receiving them, but also as a defensive measure.
So the important thing to remember there, though, is that temporary insanities are gained by either being stressed in your willpower or strained. There are no checks. So if you are strained and you take 2 more stress because something of fear 2, you fail a discipline check against something of fear 2, or if you do an extra maneuver and you take a point of fatigue, you're going to get a temporary insanity. No check. Boom. It's going to be there.
Well, let's kind of transition to, so we've mentioned 2 things. We've mentioned the temporary insanities, which you're going to get. You'll probably see many, many more of those than you do a permanent insanity. But the permanent insanities come about from these temporary insanities. You do make a check at the end of an adventure to see if those temporary ones, you can shrug them off, or if maybe they settle in for long term.
Right. And, so
that's maybe where those tests kind of come in.
So the source of stress or fatigue that causes the temporary insanity is tracked. So when you get a temporary insanity, you receive a number of tokens on that temporary insanity equal to the amount of stress or fatigue that caused it. So if you take 4 points of stress, say you fail a terror 2 check, so you take 2 points of stress, 2 points of fatigue, and you're strained, you get a temporary insanity, and that temporary insanity is given 4 tokens because you've received 2 stress and 2 fatigue caused the insanity. For example, if you're strained and you do an extra maneuver, so you take 1 fatigue, you get a temporary insanity, and then you get 1 token on it. The tokens is what you use to determine whether you can, whether that insanity turns permanent after the end of the act. It's not necessarily, that's what it's written in the rules, end of the encounter usually, or somewhere along those lines. And that's where you make a simple willpower check. It's not even a discipline check. You make a simple willpower check, and you need the number of successes equal to the number of tokens on the insanity to get rid of it. If you don't get that number of successes, then that insanity turns permanent.
So some of the insanities have like a severity rating of like 3 or 4, which are actually very hard to shrug off. Many of them are just like 1s or 2s. But there are even some rules in the system to, which I think are great, to actually remove permanent insanities. And those are much more on the GM to kind of maybe role play out, or to what degree you're willing to, allow some kind of doctor to tinker in your head using old world tools to try and remove this insanity. And that you can really create some fun things. But at a certain point, your character, if they build up enough insanities, That character may be lost to the loony bin.
Yeah, once you get the number of insanities over, I believe it's your willpower.
Yep.
So that's then you've pretty much gone NPC, and you've gone off the deep end. And the thing that you mentioned about severity, so all of these special condition cards, critical wounds, which we talked about in an earlier episode, insanities that we're talking about right now, and additionally, diseases, they all have a severity. What the severity is what you need to make the test against to get rid of it. So, as you mentioned, when you can do a discipline check, basically, how often do they let you do that?
Once a month.
Yeah, once a month you're allowed to do a discipline check, and if you get the number of successes on that simple discipline check, against, I think that's right, you need, you get that discipline check, and then you need to get as many successes as the severity of that insanity to get rid of it.
But if you get like 2 1 month and it's a severity 3, then you basically track that you've gotten 2 successes and you just need 1 additional success to shake that off. Is that correct?
Yep, that does work. That does work over time.
Oh, so you actually will. So what that mechanic is representing is your character healing himself. As time goes on, you will eventually shrug off the disease if you can just kind of rest and relax and allow enough time.
Yeah, and you can also use fortune points to temporarily make the insanity go dormant, but you have to spend fortune points equal to the severity to make it go dormant until the end of the action, and then that insanity comes back.
That's actually quite a bit then. If the severity rating 3, you'd have to drop all your fortune points for the act to push it down.
Yeah.
Oh, and actually, I apologize. I was mixing up the disease with the insanity. You make simple discipline checks against the insanity, but you need a number of successful checks equal to the severity of the insanity. So if you've got a severity 3 insanity, that means it's
wrong choice.
That means it's gonna take at least 3 months to get rid of that insanity.
Paul, that was not me, so you don't yell at me. That's probably Jesse.
It was me in my drunken state.
So that's actually a different thing, and that's unfortunately one of the things that is, it can be a little confusing, is that they do get a little cute. I mean, it gives a different flavor to it, so diseases aren't just like critical wounds, and they aren't just like insanities, but remembering those little tweaks that, oh, I need the number of successful checks over time for insanities versus like critical wounds and diseases, which we'll transition into very quickly, where you just have to get the number of successes equal to the severity to get rid of it.
Well, being a big fan of Nurgle, I want to go into diseases.
Yeah, so.
I need to.
I want to start using these on my players.
Yes, everybody does. The fun thing with diseases is that they can be really handed out in so many different ways. I mean, it could be you sleep in a dirty bed, you hop in the swamp, you swim in the canal, you get hit by...
You go to a barber surgeon who has...
Rusty blades.
Really clean tools. Yeah.
I like that one.
And I try to work it into every single game that I game master. I try to work a potential for disease in every game.
Absolutely. And, you know, frankly, it's the most fun role-playing when your character has problems to deal with that are their own. You know, so when you have an insanity or a disease, that's when the creativity really starts boiling out when you're actually role-playing your character. So, I'm not sure how to say this, but try and give your characters something to deal with. You know, make sure they get a disease somehow. Have some fun with it.
Well, wounds come and wounds go, right? I mean, even with things like critical wounds and the severe injuries that we got out of Omens of War, you know, those are at least making wounds interesting. But the idea that, you know, we talked about this a lot last time, when we talked about, or what the system spotlighted on wounds, you know, that idea that you're not impaired until you're dead. Insanity, disease, corruption, these are ways to challenge and impair your characters without killing them outright, which is very cool.
Well, yeah, it doesn't matter if the Ironbreaker has a really good soak in defense. If he falls into a quagmire that gives him a disease, he's just as susceptible to die as the next guy, you know?
Well, and you can't go through the old world with no, you know, complete no harm. I mean, it's kind of nice to add a new element to it, and I think that that's a more enjoyable factor, because when you have something like this, it's not life-threatening, but it adds a new element that someone has to overcome, and I think that that gives an edge to the player because they learn how to overcome certain obstacles. So you give them something that's a minor disadvantage, and they learn how to deal with it, and I think that that probably makes them better when they start making decisions.
You know, I kind of feel that diseases are the easiest ones, or the ones that should be most freely incorporated into games and exposed to your players often, while insanities, the GM doesn't always have the ability to actually just hand them out or cause them on the players, but you kind of have like an easy, medium, and difficult series to the insanity, disease, insanity, and corruption, where the you know, diseases are, while they impact your character pretty heavily, they can also be gotten rid of. They're not as life-threatening or as permanent, while corruption, on the other hand, is very permanent and arguably the most severe damage your character can take.
Well, and that's a really good point, Jesse, because the difference between insanity and this disease and corruption is that disease and corruption, to get diseases or to gain corruption points, you do take a test. So there is exposure either to chaos energies, which causes corruption, or there's exposes to sources of disease, which causes disease. And there's a specific test. It's a resilience test against that. So there is a, you know, simple, easy, hard, difficult test, disease test, or corruption test that your characters take. And if they fail that test, then they gain it. Versus insanity, which we just talked about, is insanity is almost driven upon yourself. I mean, there may be tests that come from things like fear or terror or even like miscasts or things like that, but primarily it's when the character pushes themselves too far, they're going to run into insanities.
Absolutely.
Yeah, or if they roll too many banes, then you may be able to lump up a bunch of stress on them and then make them take insanities.
Right. So diseases, they actually not only give your character a negative to it, and as we mentioned with the insanities, there's traits that are specific for it. Contact, filth, miasma, all of those sorts of things. But there's a negative effect that's given to them, and they also, reduce your character's ability by taking up one of their talent slots.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that I like about it, is that it just locks up all kinds of stuff for your character besides just the standard. You're gonna be a little bit weaker here or there.
It really makes you feel like you're sick when you have that big green card slotted up on your character sheet. You just,
yeah, like,
your character feels
black leg. You got black leg with severity of 9, and then you're trying to hobble around, and then you get your eye put out or something.
The descriptions of the diseases are the best part. I mean, the names and the descriptions are just classic.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So one of the other unique things about the disease in terms of these special conditions is that they can stack. So you can gain not just multiple diseases, but you can gain multiple symptoms on the disease. And then those are, when you fail additional tests, either during treatment or you get exposed to more disease, you draw another card, you slot that card under the first one, so you didn't get a second disease, you still got blackleg, but instead of blackleg just being painful, now it's also infectious. And those negatives stack on top of each other, and when you're going to cure the disease, you've got to attack the symptoms first before you can get rid of the full disease. And again, those are all based on the severity as well. And just like with insanities, once you get a certain number of insanities over your willpower, you're dead for all intents and purposes. You're insane and an NPC. With disease, if one of your disease stacks, if the total number of severities in your disease stack is greater than your wound threshold, then you succumb to the disease and die.
And we can't forget Nurgle's Rot, and if you die from that, you become a plague bearer. Mm-hmm. And remember that diseases are actually a gift from Grandfather Nurgle. So
that's right.
Embrace your diseases, player.
Embrace.
So the last one I wanted to talk about here is the corruption. So this is the exposure, and this was actually a little bit controversial on the forums when I mentioned that Omens of War should be more about corruption and less about the
blood. You did start a little
bit
of a firestorm there, didn't you? Yeah. Actually, so I agreed with you in last episode, and since then I've finished reading this scenario, and I've read some of the forum arguments, and I actually no longer agree with you. I'm curious if you've kind of come around.
No, I definitely agree with them. So the difference is it a morality tracker or is it magical radiation? Corruption is absolutely magical radiation. It's the corrupting influence of chaos. But the concept, and again, I don't want to go into spoilers or anything like that, but the concept of leaning towards chaos exposes you to that corruption. It's you can't go down that path, go down to the dark side without coming into contact with it.
So it's like maybe it's the whispering in your ear that's corrupting your mind. It's not so much that you're going to burst out of mutations at the very early stages, but there is something in there. You're right.
So that's the piece to roll it back into this. That's the piece that people forget about corruption too, is that the effects of corruption, if you get a certain amount of corruption over your corruption threshold, which is based on your race and your toughness, it's 5+ toughness for humans, 10+ for the elder, 10+ toughness for the elder races. If you go over your corruption threshold, if you're an elder race, you gain an insanity and your corruption is reduced by the severity of the insanity. Or if you're a human, you gain a mutation and your corruption is reduced by the severity of the mutation. Additionally to that, the GM can invoke corruption at any point in the game. By cashing in one corruption point from a player, the GM can add a purple dice to any roll. And that's the whispers in the head. That's the pieces that's saying, you know, the thing that trips you up, or that your arm seizes, or that, you know, you're listening to the voices in your head. So that's also in there as well. And the idea that they didn't plug that into the system or into the adventure in Omens of War is probably the disappointing part for me.
You always got to have a sound argument for it, don't you?
Well, fair enough. But I do think that if you are, you know, going about pleasing Nurgle in some way, even if you're not conscious that you're doing that, he's going to focus on you, and by him focusing on you, you're going to be getting more of these corrupting influences, this magical radiation, if you will.
You know, I'm not sure that just the Chaos Gods focusing on you generates the corruption. That kind of gains their interest, and they kind of attempt to push you in directions. But the actual, you know, the physical contact with chaotic energies, or you know, a demonic spirit and things like that, that's what actually generates the corruption points, and those can then be, like Paul said, cashed in to trigger the effects. You know, like in example, you know, maybe you have a demon bound artifact or something like that. You know, that in possession of that artifact, you know, maybe the demon could be talking to you. You know, that's common in a variety of Warhammer adventures that are out there. You know, something like that could actually generate some, that could in that scenario generate the the whispers in the head, but also the corruptive influences.
Now, can we all agree that warp stone may be the most corrupting substance on the face of the old world?
Yes.
Sure.
Absolutely.
That's almost like chaos energy and rock. That's real
exactly.
Common. Skaven, I mean, we mentioned yes. That in our previous episodes.
Yeah. It's Skaven is very influential with Skaven, especially it's become part of their social culture. I mean, it's in everything. It's in, their spell casting. It's in their technology. They really rely on it.
It's in their diet.
Exactly. They eat it. Look at their rat ogres. I mean, that's like,
Even being in contact with the warp stone does, depending on the quantity of the warp stone you come in contact with, does generate a resilience check or suffer some corruption points. And, whether you ingest it or you touch it or you have it in your pocket, or maybe if you're wounded by a demon or your demon touches you or you're too close to, the chaos waste or exposure to the chaos waste for long periods of time. All those kind of things build up these corruption that eventually hit this ceiling where your body just can't maintain this chaotic energy inside it any longer and eventually just has to erupt in some other way. And that other way is physically manifesting in a mutation.
Yeah, growing an eye.
And the mutation library is the coolest part about it. I mean, Mark, have you guys... You guys are new to the Warhammer role-playing game. Are you new to Warhammer in general, or is it has it been?
No, I'm not. They are, but I've been playing since actually before I was role-playing. I was.
So you're very familiar then with the chaotic energies and corruption and things like that.
Oh yeah, I've actually been looking at possibly running eventually a campaign set in Mordheim.
Nice.
To allow a lot of warp stone in there and things like that.
So quick question on that. I was actually thinking about bringing it up when Dan was mentioning the warp stone. I believe in Mordheim it's called Weird Stone.
Yes. It was, yes,
what,
it
is it the same? Is it, or is it different?
It's just a different name for it.
Yeah, they took on a different name.
It took place back before, Skaven were more prominent in the world in the year 2000. I think the current year is 3,400 or something. So it took place, almost 2,000 years ago. So they didn't really know much about warp stone at all, and so at the time it was just called Weird Stone, and nobody really quite knew what it did. But the rumor was that it could turn lead into gold, which is what caused it to be such a highly sought commodity in the city of Mordheim.
Excellent. So currently there are the ruins of Mordheim, which are kind of just north of Sylvania. You can find that on the map pretty easily.
Which they had initially not really said where Mordheim was exactly. And a lot of people had speculated that it was Talibheim because Talibheim is built inside of a crater.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think they've derailed from that because there's several places that reference it now.
Exactly, yeah.
The crater of Mordheim was formed from a giant shard of warp stone, like a meteor, falling and just exploding into that area, destroying the city and shattering these warp stone shards all over the place.
Yeah, for about, I think, 300 or 400 years, there was people raiding the city until Magnus the Pious finally showed up and just completely razed the place to the ground.
Hmm. Cool. All
right.
So these corruptions, I mean, the mutations, that's one of the coolest parts of the whole game. I mean, let's talk a little bit about mutants in general, because now is probably the perfect time for it. Paul, what's your take on Warhammer mutants? I mean, they're kind of one of your stereotypical bad guys when you're fighting a cult, but how do you kind of feel mutants fit into society in Warhammer?
It's actually interesting because if you go back to the previous, editions of the role-playing game, the mutants are the foot soldiers of chaos. It isn't so much the beastmen that live in the woods. It's that there's bands of mutants that live in the woods, and there might be a couple of beastmen that hang out there as well. It's really quite prominent, not so much, definitely in first edition, and a little bit less in second edition. And third edition, you don't really run into, bands of mutants that have been kicked out of society running through the wilds and forests of the Empire. That's kind of been taken over by the Beastmen and the Ungors and that kind of idea. There's actually, you know, a thought that Beastmen are mutants. They're just a particular strain of mutants that have those bestial forms. And if you have a beast form but no horns, then you're an Ungor and at the bottom rung, and then, you know, you've got the Gors and the War Gors. But the idea that the mutants were also in those Beastmen war bands, but they were below the Ungors, was an interesting thing that I think is lost in the more recent ones of that. So really, where you find mutants now is, you know, within society. So the cultists that have a mutant that's hiding their mutation. And
well, interesting you should bring that up, that it's the hiding mutations and the mutants in society is a really, really important aspect to Warhammer, because mutation is any kind of mutation or anything that's different from the norm of society is considered a mutation. So, you know, like somebody who's born with any kind of deformity, or they have an extra finger, or you know, whatever might be considered today just a standard genetic differentiation, would be considered a mutation in Warhammer, in addition to whatever actually is chaotic energies causing mutations. So many times people who are not actually mutated are perceived as being mutated and are often ostracized from society. The other neat thing is that misconception I had for a long time and still struggle with periodically is that just because you have a mutation does not necessarily turn you into this mindless, chaotic war machine. More often than not, having a mutation, you still are exactly who you were before, but you've got this freaky mutation, or maybe it's obvious, maybe it's less obvious, maybe you've just got an eye on the back of your shoulder that you can easily conceal, and you want to still maintain your life, and you spend the rest of your life trying to hide that from everybody else. So that is a huge part of Warhammer, where many, many people who are still living completely ordinary lives may have something hidden underneath their cloak that they don't want other people to see. Doesn't necessarily mean they're a follower of chaos, because many people still maintain all their mental faculties. Not all of them do. Some of them go nuts, some of them don't. But you can really have fun with that. If ever your characters generate a mutation, that becomes a tremendous role-playing element where they all of a sudden are going to be ostracized from society, and they may need to find a way to hide that if they want to continue living the life they do.
Yeah, I think it needs to be said that a mutation also, not only is it a penalty, but it adds benefits for the most part.
It can, yeah. A lot of them can be pretty substantial too.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the things I like about the mutants is that how sympathetic they can actually be. You can play them up a lot to be very sad, sad people, because they don't want this. They suddenly have a tentacle growing out of their armpit, and now what are they going to do with their lives? And I think you can play it up really well, both people trying to hide it and then those who have been ostracized.
Yeah, the ones who have been ostracized, driven out of town, and formed those like war bands of people who want to just get back at the people who threw them out. You know, that's perfect.
Yeah.
Or the mothers who have the baby who was born with a mutation and have to decide if they need to leave it out in the forest to have nature take care of it, or hide the baby and try and raise it in her attic because, you know, she can't just bear to part with it. Those things create awesome stories.
I think Witch's Song, again, not to go into spoiler territory, but if you guys are interested in exploring those kinds of ideas, that theme definitely goes through the Witch's Song, and I recommend it. It's definitely one of the good adventures that's out there for third edition.
Well, that one's about a witch hunter. Right?
Witch hunters are big.
But the concept of, it's not just the hedge wizard there, but the idea of corruption and mutation is also a part of that adventure. So.
Well, yeah, well, being a hedge wizard makes you more susceptible to that.
Sounds great. So we'll take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll have our general topic, which is going to be a little bit of a free-for-all for this time. So we'll see you in a bit.
And
And we're back. So for our main topic today, we're just kind of throw it open here. We don't have a specific topic, but just kind of do a roundtable on what are our current thoughts and experiences around Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition, any of our play sessions or preparation for play that we've done. And I think I'd like to kick it off with our special guest here, with Mark, and talk a little bit about what you're seeing with Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay and with your group that you're just starting up with.
Well, my group just started up probably about a month and a half ago. We try to meet weekly, but we've only been meeting probably about every 3 or 4 weeks. But my group of players are horrible people. The first mission was based roughly on the what was it called?
The Daylight and the Shilling Short.
Yeah. And one of the characters was transporting the other one, who was a prisoner. He was taking him to Altdorf. They ended up running onto another caravan that was being attacked by orcs. And they ended up going and taking down the orcs. But in the meantime, the coachman ended up freeing the dwarven thief. So then they were on the run from the police. They ended up with wanted posters everywhere, and they ended up fighting the town guard to escape a town. And now they have even worse wanted posters out there. So they're currently criminals, and I've been trying to figure out how to make it so that they're heroes, but it's going to be a long, long road before I figure out.
You're going to have to do one of those things where you make the villains... who are currently villains have to do something in order to save the world, but the rest of the world is still chasing them, and nobody will realize they're the good guys until they've succeeded.
Like Batman.
Like Batman.
Yeah. That's kind of what I was thinking. I was thinking about actually putting, having them discover a big, huge underground network of tunnels for Skaven, and then causing them to sort of have to stop the Skaven from hatching a plan that it's gonna overthrow all the human towns in the area, and as such, then it would make them heroes for having been selfless in that. But the problem is that based on what I've seen so far, I'm guessing the players might just say, "We're likely to die that way, so we'll go ahead and leave that and let the cities get overrun."
Do you think it's because of the nature of the players that you have, or do they understand that Warhammer is so deadly and things like that, so becoming a hero will stick your neck out and you'll wind up with insanity and corruptions and disease and, you know, critical wounds and all that kind of stuff?
I think it's that second one there. I think they realize how dangerous it is. And it's probably because in the first session they ended up taking on this big burly orc, and it was both of them against one orc, and they nearly died. So I think they've now realized how dangerous the world is, and they'd rather just sort of make their way in the world doing what they want and not really caring what the authorities think. The problem is one of the players wants to be a witch hunter, and then one of the players wants to be a slayer. So it's trying to figure out how to get that fitted into their overall stories.
Well, he's obviously, the Slayer has done something so horrible at this point that maybe he needs to start repenting for his sins and turn himself into a Slayer.
Yeah, and I was considering having it that his wife and children are killed by a bunch of orcs back in his home Carrick, and that if he had been there, he would have been able to defend them. But since he wasn't there, they died, and so maybe that would be a good reason for him to go Slayer mode.
I like that. Yeah. That's a great way to do it. That's interesting that, you know, you've got characters that are moving in that direction versus just starting out with that. Did you have your guys do random careers, or did you let them pick careers?
They did. They did 3 random careers and picked one. That's how I ended up with the dwarf thief, because he didn't end up with the Slayer, and it's a player who, from what I've seen so far, he only plays dwarves. So he decided that was the way he wanted to go. And then almost immediately, the guy who was playing the coachman switched over to be a hunter. So, and in fact, it was the next session that he after the first session that he switched over to become the hunter, and now he's going to be working his way towards becoming that witch hunter.
So he's got to gather his insanity and maybe go zealot and yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
That sounds cool, and I think that's great that because you did the random career generation, you know, they didn't start off with that. You didn't start off as an iron breaker or a war dancer or stuff like that, even though they're basic careers. But it's something, it's a goal for them. It's something for them to move forward towards.
And then the new player he started off as a thug.
Hmm.
He had a bunch of options for different classes, and he chose just to be a general thug with carrying around the equivalent of a baseball bat. So I'm looking forward to seeing where he ends up.
It sounds like he fits in that group you've got going.
Oh yeah. I ended up fitting him right into the story where he was a friend of one of the guys and
excellent.
So he was able to fit right into the story.
Did you use a party card for them? Do you have
I did. They're the Brash Young
Gang
Ghouls,
of Thugs,
actually.
That's a good one.
The problem is it does say idealistic on it, and they aren't really idealistic, but everything else matches them pretty well. So they decided after the first session, because I didn't give them a party sheet from the start. I waited until the first session was over, and they sort of saw how their characters interacted with one another, and that's how I did the Brash Young Fools.
It's a great way to do it.
That's great. Yeah, that's a really great idea.
Make them earn the party sheet.
What about the rest of us? Have we gotten any gaming in? Have we thought about gaming?
I always think a lot about gaming, but I did manage to get one game in over the last few weeks, which was an introductory adventure. And it was myself and one other person, and we did a game where the person played a commoner who was a goat farmer up in Kislev, and they were in an economic battle with one of the neighboring farms, and which throughout the course of the adventure, she discovered that the neighboring farm was actually corrupting and poisoning her rival farm's wares, and which led them then into a chase into the forest, and where she met some crazy kind of forest people and some who were maybe a little too friendly with some nearby animals, and then there was a dire beaver, and there was all sorts of horrible things. But it ended up being a really exciting and fun adventure, trying to introduce some of the concepts and of Warhammer and where everything seems nice up on the surface, but underneath there's a lot of corruption and backstabbing that goes on, or a little bit of the darkness underneath the surface. So we had a lot of fun with that. And, turned out to be a good adventure. Got her into role playing.
Nice.
Yeah, I really like dire beavers. They're awesome.
The dire beaver actually turned out to be very exciting. It was, there was a very cinematic moment where this, overgrown, ravenous beaver appeared and, put on quite the show and slaughtered Helga Kirkoff's lovely brother.
Nice.
Beavers tend to be exciting.
How did you stat that one up?
I ran it like a giant boar. And I think I might have even, I think I just pulled the stats straight from that, because I figured it was of comparable size, a woodland creature, and pretty much that boar could be anything. I mean, you know, if it's whether it be a bear or whatnot, you can just flop a dice up one in any category, and you're probably about right.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and that's kind of nice with how the creature stats are done, is that they are pretty much just a sketch of the creature, and the personality really kind of comes into it in my mind in what actions you choose that creature to have or do, you know, kind of defines their abilities around that. So I think it's pretty flexible to move things around, you know, add a add a trait here, add a plus one or a minus one here or there, you know, use this different action, and you can put a lot of variety into the creatures that exist there today.
Yeah, the other fun thing I had with the adventure was that it was an introductory adventure, and she had not played a role-playing game before at all, so I kind of taught her the rules and taught her some of the concepts, and the Warhammer rule set was actually very easy to pick up, you know, conceptually, and you know, she was up and running with it within minutes. So that was actually a nice little tip of my hat to the game design.
For sure, I've had very similar experiences introducing people to the game. Definitely.
So Lester, you've recently been able to include things to your library. So what have you picked up that you've enjoyed digging into? Is there, do you have a favorite?
Well, I do like Omens of War. I think I'm gonna like Winds of Magic when I get that, and I am really, really curious about what's the, you were talking about earlier, the Witch's Song. I like the idea of having magic as a viability away from being a college magician. So that's gonna be exciting. But I really have to say I do like what they did with Omens of War. I was surprised, like you were, at how much general information was in that book. The Omens of War book, they crammed so much fluff into it. It just, that's what I like. That's probably my favorite part about the game is the books. And, really what I'm doing right now is I'm trying to get a solid group together because my local group they're pretty MIA. They're not really committed. So I'm trying to find a group that can help me do some consistent play testing for this Travel and Its Perils system that I'm working on. But I need to play test it so that I can work out the kinks, because you'll notice that most games are heavily playtested, and as of right now, I can see there being lots of holes and kinks in the system, and I need to kind of tighten it up before I really develop it any further and actually release it to the general public to play around with. But I'm looking forward to trying to get that together. I'd like to do that for Reckless Dice here. And I've also kind of, not necessarily in the vein of playing, but I've been talking with the guys at Beasts of War. It's like they're like an Irish group of guys who does a miniature wargaming. It was a YouTube channel, but they have their own website and everything now. And they have a pretty struggling role-playing game section, and I offered my services to do reviews of this game, of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, the third edition, and they sound pretty keen to let me do that. So hopefully over the next month or so, I'll be able to get up about, you know, 10 reviews on all the different products that I've managed to get in my hands. I want to run more games though. We've got to wrap up Eye for an Eye, and we've got to get playing here.
Yeah, we do. Well, we almost got that one back up and running again. You know, we're having to start with a new group and try and wrap up that adventure with some new players. But you know, I know Lester, you're keen to do it. I know Danger Bunny is ready to go. And,
oh, yeah.
Helga Kirkhoff here is interested in joining as well, so the Kislevite Goat Farmer is ready to participate.
I have to say I really like that, how you did that, how you made you can do those kind of storylines in Warhammer where you're not necessarily the heroic person. You can be the rat catcher, you can be the commoner, you can be the scribe or whatever, and experience the world from that kind of point of view.
Well, I figured I chose to do that specifically in this scenario because I had to try and figure out a way where I could tell somebody who doesn't really know the Warhammer world why it's cool. And I think the only place that really has to start is from the bottom. I mean, you can't just be thrown right in and be like, well, yeah, here, there's these guys and these guys. You kind of just got to see it and get exposed to that little bit of chaos and then understand a little bit more of it. And hopefully, at least I feel I'm doing that successfully. So hopefully that continues.
Yeah. So Dan, I didn't want to leave you out, but I figured with your wrapping up your college career there, I don't know if you've gotten much gaming in at all.
I have not touched a book a gaming book. I've touched lots of books, but not a gaming book in probably a month. So I'm really looking forward to trying to get some games, and I'm kind of bummed that my graduation is on the weekend of KoopaCon, because I was really excited to see Jesse and hang out.
I could say the same.
Yeah, well, whatever. I don't like you anymore. Don't forget who got you a hotel room, okay?
Don't forget who dubbed the Kodan the Barbarian.
That's true. That's true. I'm looking forward to now relaxing, knowing I don't have any more school, and really stepping in to play games, because I've been really missing games. So I'm looking forward to hopefully getting some in pretty soon. Hopefully you guys are online so I can get some going.
Well, you go enjoy your weekend, man, because you've deserved it. That's a long, hard road.
Yeah, so I'm very excited. Saturday is going to be a very influential day in my life, so very excited for it. Cool. So.
Well, and from my perspective, I don't have the excuse that Dan has, but I've probably gamed probably about as much as he has too. So it's been a lot of springtime, I guess, stuff catching up with me, but definitely been doing a lot of reading, digging into the books, going back over the adventures. One of the things that for me, I'm trying to see how much time it would take me to actually put together my own adventures. So I'm reading a lot of folks that are out there who are doing their own adventures. Some of those blog sites that are out there where you can upload your characters and upload your adventure, and they kind of track everything up there for you. Mm-hmm. I know that there's a couple of them out there. I can't think of the name of that, but I've got some acquaintances and friends who have put up their campaigns, Warhammer and otherwise. And it always interests me. I would like to make that creative leap from, instead of running a published adventure, to make.
Have you ever
own
considered doing those one pagers, like kind of like they have on the Daily Empire? Like, that's a really good way to take a stab at a short, simple, like one encounter adventure that, you know, is kind of all encompassing, instead of just trying to tackle a multi chapter adventure right off the bat.
Yeah, and it's definitely a good idea, and I think some of that is also in, you know, like the GM toolkit and the GM guide, where they've got those kind of episode templates that they have as well. I think that's definitely the pieces and parts. I think that's probably a good point, though, because I've probably almost exclusively played RPGs in a campaign setting. It hasn't been a lot of one-offs or short-form type mm-hmm. stuff. I'm always thinking about, okay, where are these guys going to be in 3 years or something like that. Mm-hmm. So not that I ever get to that point, right? Not since college have I had a, you know, a regular weekly game where we can spend 4 hours and, you know, really, really advance the characters. So, you know, being where I'm at with the kid and the wife and the job and the house and all that kind of stuff, you know, I'm lucky if I play once a month, in person. But I'd definitely like to get back into the online stuff.
Yeah,
It's been a while. I enjoyed getting the Gathering Storm, that first part of that, out there, and I think there's a lot of cool stuff that we could do with that. And there's actually, you know, along those lines, I've got some old first edition and second edition stuff here on my shelf that I'd like to convert and kind of use for some of the third edition stuff. I'm looking specifically at the Lishmaster adventure from first edition. I think that would be a pretty fun third edition game too. So I think I'm swinging back, you know, kind of doing the computer game thing a little earlier this month or so, but I think I'm swinging back to wanting to get back into Warhammer.
I find myself thinking a lot about Warhammer and like almost playing it all out in my head and everything more than actually playing the games right now, which is, I think of new projects and everything, but like you said, not a lot of it's actually translating into game time.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think I have to say, getting back to what Jesse said about those one-offs, those like the things that come in the Game Master's Toolkit and what they've been doing on the Daily Empire, I think those are more conducive for online games. If you can get like one or two encounter adventures together that can be run in an hour and a half, I think that would probably be a little bit easier for the podcast if we did things like that, taking turns game mastering short adventures.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree. Well, certainly that would lend itself better to the because we have a roster of about 45 people who want to participate in MapTools adventures. So it's very difficult to be able to say, like, hey, cool, let's start a campaign with four guys and then exclude everybody else. So I think these one-off adventures where we can maybe, like, you know, cycle some people through, get them exposed to map tools and playing with it, and then maybe they can then go out on their own and start playing games with their friends and kind of get that community rolling, that probably sounds like it'd be the best way for us to handle it.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
You had mentioned a little bit ago running stuff from first or second edition games.
Mm-hmm.
I would definitely recommend anybody who's looking for older edition stuff to convert over, look in the Plundered Vaults from second edition.
Oh, I love that one. What's that adventure where you get tricked into going into that house and then get abducted? That's a great one.
Yeah, I like the Rough Knight at Three Feathers. That's the one where there's like 12 different things going on all at the same time, and you have to keep track of the actual time because different things will go off at certain times, and you're trying to figure out all the different complicated little things that are going on. I would love to run something like that.
Man, I read that adventure, and it was a very interesting read, and the story's cool, but I am literally terrified as a GM to attempt to even try to tackle that.
Oh, yeah, it is really, really scary to think about, but... I'd love to give you
guys. Yeah, Rough Knight at the Three Feathers definitely has a cachet outside of Warhammer. I mean, it's one of those things that people talk about and have a certain amount of awe with. Graham Davis, one of the writers of Knight at the Three Feathers, he's actually the primary writer, I believe, of Edge of Night.
Oh, okay.
And if you read Edge of Night, again, not going into the spoilers, but the climax of Edge of Night isn't an evening at an inn, but it's an evening at a noble's
I can
ball.
See some of the parallels in storytelling there.
Yep, a social function. And it is kind of broken down into that similar fashion. There's the 15-minute timeline. This happens, then this happens, then this happens. Here's the important plot points. And it's all got Skaven in it.
Excellent.
So I think, Mark, from your perspective, you know, you want to throw a little corruption, you want to throw a little Skaven in there, and you want to throw a little feel of Knight of the Three Feathers on it. You might want to take a look at that Edge of Night. That's another one of the good adventures that I like that third edition's come
out
with.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to check that out.
Cool. So anything else, guys, or shall we move on to the break and then wrap things up with some questions?
Let's do some questions.
Questions. Q&A.
As always, you can submit your questions to recklessdice@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter @recklessdice. Zwobot asks via an email, what is your take on the two adventures, Gathering Storm and Edge of Night? Why did the author teams do such a bad job on them? When Edge of Night and Witch's Song are on the same level as first and some second edition adventures, did the team not play those scenarios? I had to rewrite 20% of the Gathering Storm and 80% of the Edge of Night just to make them bearable. So that's a pretty heavy comment. But what are your guys' takes on the Gathering Storm and Edge of Night? Did, as a whole, did you guys like them?
I like the Gathering Storm. I thought the Gathering Storm was good from a campaign standpoint. I mean, that's definitely, I think what he says is that he doesn't like Gathering Storm and Edge of Night, but he does like Eye for an Eye and Witch's Song. I think that's what Zwobot was getting across. Gathering Storm does have a little bit of a tacked on feel to it. I mean, it's pretty obvious that there's three separate encounters and then kind of the meta campaign that ties them together.
That meta campaign, I think, is pretty weak.
And that's really the place where, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff that happens in those three adventures, but there's so many things that you can do in Stromdorf. You know, just if they would have thrown in some, like, random adventures or things like that in Stromdorf, as opposed to this is where you tie the first adventure to the second adventure, this is where you do the second to the third, and then this is how you wrap it all up. You know, here's the introduction, here's the two in pieces, and here's the wrap-up stuff. I think if there was more life to Stromdorf as a town or a village on its own, and then those adventures were kind of in there as well, that could probably make that whole campaign a lot better. But I do think that, you know, there is kind of a progression of Eye for an Eye to Gathering Storm to Edge of Night. I think those three is kind of a, really makes for a great, campaign arc if you're wanting to go off of book. And that's definitely what I'm doing with my group, my local group, running them through that.
So Edge of Night, what were your thoughts on that one? I've read through that one, but haven't played it yet. But it, like you said, it has that kind of, Knight of the Three Feathers Inn, kind of vibe to it. You know, I kind of dug it.
I definitely did too, but I think just like Gathering Storm, I think the big part is everything around the ball. All right. So there's the ball that the PCs attend, and then kind of the climax and the resolution that happens during the ball or shortly after the ball. But everything leading up to the ball, again, you know, this is in some parts the source book for Überstreich, which is the hometown of Warhammer 3rd Edition, right? That's where they're at. So the idea of what happens in Überstreich is very sketchy. I mean, they do a good kind of a travelogue of here's all the important places to hit, but they don't necessarily tell you, well, here's some of the things that you can do. Now, of course, if you're going through, you know, your campaign, and this is more of a second or third rank adventure, then you've hopefully already got, you know, who's your patron in Überstreich, who have you dealt with, and I think you guys saw that, and again, the readers at home or the listeners at home haven't, but I kind of tried to do that with the Gathering Storm. When you guys left for Stromdorf, I tried to introduce you to some of the people in Überstreich, right. So if we ever do rope back around, you say, oh, I know who the Merchant Guild is because I talked to them and they sent me off to Stromdorf.
I feel the style, maybe a criticism to the style that they write the adventures, just in third edition in general, is in a very loose format. And I maybe am just more used to or grew up with the adventures that had kind of here's an event, here's the cause and effect of the following scenarios, and then it transitions into this one. And the way that the adventures are written are much more in a narrative story format, and I think they can at times be very difficult to follow or in terms of transitioning them into encounters that happen in game. And I've seen that as the adventures that the Fantasy Flight's putting out, over time, those adventures are becoming slightly more structured. I think Omens of War maybe missed that ball a little bit. But I'm wondering if maybe what some of Zolbot's getting at here is that you almost have to fill in loads of your own content just to give it enough substance to hold it together.
But with the format that they have, I feel that it's actually a lot easier to manipulate it and fit it into your world and add certain things and change things around.
It is.
As opposed to if you were playing an adventure that's written, this is what happens and this is what happens and this is what happens and this is what happens, then it makes it a lot harder to...
I just feel at times I don't have all the info. I mean, like, I need to memorize everything that's in that book in order to run an adventure successfully, but so little of it is in actual tables or bullet points for me to quickly reference while in game. Everything is in paragraph format, so it's almost impossible to reference any material. So the ability to run a fluid game, I think, is hampered just by their style of writing.
Yeah, I think that comes down to the way GM, right?
Yeah, and I think that I'm sure that it's not for everybody.
Yeah, it's true. Fair enough.
But for me, I feel.
But if you take a look at things like In an Eye for an Eye, you've got the table at the end of the adventure that kind of breaks down all.
Eye for an Eye, I thought was well written, and I actually, even though it wasn't what I'm used to, that was probably the closest to what I liked. I think that some of the future adventures have kind of derailed from that more and more, and I think Omens of War derails from that the most. And it pretty much just says, here's an adventure, some things you can maybe do, and go have fun with it.
Well, and in defense of Edge of Night, you know, they didn't provide the summarization, but they did provide mini cards for all the major NPCs of the ball. So you've got the capability, you know, to have a little bit of background on them and, you know, use those cards to, to track and manage the cast of characters. But I absolutely agree that, that out of all of the adventures, including the adventures that are included with the expansions, Winds of Faith, Winds of Magic, Signs of Faith, and Omens of War, I was most disappointed by the Omens of War one.
So Angry Dragon from the Fantasy Flight forums and Jose Luis Misaguerre from the Netherlands writes in, "Hi, I'm starting up an online game with map tools and would like to know what I should download as a GM and what the players need to download. Also, any good advice on how to use it well?" I guess I should probably kind of head this one up because we do toot map tools quite a bit as an effective online gaming platform. So what you guys want to do is go to rpgtools.net. That is the home of map tools. It's free. You can download the latest client from there. Anybody who wants to be playing using map tools will have to download that client. You'll grab the same version. So everybody who's playing needs to be on the exact same version, and they release new versions every month or so. So, you know, periodically, you can continue to use an old version if you want, but as long as you guys are all using the same version, you're good. Additionally, you're going to need to download the Java client, which there's a link at the bottom of the page where you get the game client for map tools. You need to have version, I think it's 1.6 or greater. Most computers will already have that installed, but it's definitely something you want to just make sure you have. After that, I mean, that's all you need to physically run the game. I would suggest something like Skype or Ventrilo to be able to talk to your players, though some people like to just do it all through type, which is available in the chat client built into map tools. And then once you've got map tools up and running, I'm assuming you want to play Warhammer. You're welcome to use the rule set that I have up on gitsmansgallery.com. There's a template adventure at the very top of that list, and that you can just, only the GM needs to have that. So all your players need is to have the map tools client and the Java installed, and they'll just connect to the GM server, and the server will distribute out the adventure files to everybody who connects. So it can actually be pretty simple that way. Outside of that, I mean, have fun with it. There's a lot of great tutorial videos. I link to some of them on my site, and also the map tools page has several tutorials on just kind of how to navigate the map tools interface and how to design maps of your own.
I think one of the important points that we want to highlight too is that running map tools is not an excuse for having the equipment, having the rules.
Absolutely.
and having the gear. I mean, you can play it WFRP light, you know, with character sheets and things like that. You don't need all the tokens, but at a minimum, you know, the GM is going to need, you know, the GM's guide, the creature's guide, and probably the player's guide. And then all the players should have access or should have their own copy of the player's guide.
Yeah, absolutely. Good call.
Hey, Mark, sorry to derail things a little bit, but Mark, have you done any, I mean, as a long-term multi-system role player yourself, have you had any experience with online stuff? Have you,
I haven't played map tools too much. I've used, a couple of programs for running. I ran a single Star Wars session online, with players who, we were playing by form and decided to spend one session online.
Was that using map tools or was that something else?
It wasn't. It was,
because I know a lot of people are curious about just alternatives to map tools or, you know, other games or other platforms.
You know, I can't remember what the program was. I'm going to
Lester, what's that one? Is it called Battlegrounds?
Something like that.
I think it's Battlegrounds, yeah. 2.0 is one. And apparently there's a third edition rule set in the works by one of the community members. But that one,
mine was Vassal. I was actually using Vassal for that, which is mainly for board games and things like that. And I used the Star Wars miniatures game for a base for it, and then just had my players move their stuff around in there. But I also have played using Vassal. I've played a game of Fiasco, and that was actually, it worked really, really well. It's the only time I've actually gotten a chance to play Fiasco.
So Douglas Neal writes in, "I had a comment from one of my new players that Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay is World of Warcraft roleplaying with all the counters and recharging, etc. At first I took offense, but have decided to embrace it and take what's great from WoW into the game. could be another interesting discussion because all the chits and bits do draw more attention to mechanics and pull people away from the story. He finds it to be a struggle.
Can I slap that guy? The guy WoW. I mean, honestly, WoW, I've seen a lot of people play it. There's two different versions. The online thing, I mean, come on. That's where you've got, I mean, WoW is more, I would say, in my mind, closer to Dungeons and Dragons than anything else. Because you're using a lot of percentage, you're using more calculations. So I don't feel that WoW has any connection to Warhammer Fantasy. I mean,
apart from the fact that they totally ripped off the IP.
So I totally seeded this question so we could have this conversation in this episode. Because I figured episode 10 was the perfect one to say who came first.
Yeah, Warcraft is a direct ripoff. And in fact, there was a lawsuit by Games Workshop against Blizzard a long time ago because both StarCraft and Warcraft are direct intellectual property ripoffs of Games Workshop's games. And you know how Games Workshop is about their intellectual property.
Oh, yeah.
They were back in the day. For their credit, everything that Blizzard has done since that initial StarCraft and initial Warcraft, they've definitely created their own rich tapestry and mythos of it.
I think at their roots, they share a tremendous amount of similarities. Yes. And you know, actually, the Blizzard guys, from what I understand, when they were creating Warcraft, Orcs and Humans, the first one, is that, you know, they were huge fans of Warhammer. They played the tabletop games, and that was probably one of the originating factors that contributed to them making the Warcraft Orcs and Humans was they wanted a computer game version of it. If I remember correctly, the credits for Warcraft 1 even have some references to Games Workshop in it. And I know for sure that Warcraft 2 has some Easter eggs in the voice work of some of the units, tipping their hat to Warhammer 40K. Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Well, I mean, but in my overall feeling, I feel that this has no direct influence on Warhammer Fantasy. I believe
correct.
Warhammer Fantasy they created their own distinct full system. It has no ties. I mean, honestly, if you've ever seen people play WoW, they're the ones that are locked up going to 7-Eleven to get their 64 ounces of soda so they can stay up all night ravaging dungeons and killing dragon eggs.
What's interesting between Warhammer and WoW is they do share a lot of similarities in visual styles. I mean, Warhammer mm-hmm. has a very exaggerated armor and weapon and feature style to it, very similar to how Warcraft operates. I mean, if you had a Warcraft orc up against standing next to a Warhammer orc, there's quite a bit of similarities. Now, over time, they've kind of attempted to differentiate. WoW has attempted to differentiate itself a little bit more. They've taken on a lot more of the that Asian art styles to kind of mix with that Western art style. And they've kind of got that now very stylistic approach to it, which is they've kind of taken as their own. Warhammer has continued to maintain their original art style that they've had for ages.
Yeah.
Well, and not to extend the discussion further, but I'm going to jump in with the mechanics stuff because I'm me. you know, RPGs back in the day, and Mark, you can back me up on this. You know, it was you had actions and you did an action. And if you wanted to do an action every turn, you did the action every turn. So the idea of recharge, which in WoW is cooldown, so that you can't do your big swing every single turn. And that's all that you do is you just my turn, I swing. But you've got this cooldown effect. I think that is definitely something that role-playing games in general, not just Warhammer 3rd Edition, have taken from the MMO.
Right, but let's think about it for a second, that MMOs are just digital versions of our pen and paper role-playing games. Of course they're going to share mechanics. I mean, they have to.
Yeah. Well, and the best thing about a tabletop is you can do tons of things that you can't do in a computer game. Like, you can't go climbing in Warhammer. That is my 100% draw of a line. You're a real role-playing game when you can jump up on the table and dump the tankard on somebody's head. If you can't do that, then it's not a real role-playing game. It is a computer game.
Yeah.
But I'd have to disagree that the chits and bits draw the attention away from the mechanics or from the story. I think that if you teach your players early on to have good habits with the bits, and so they know when to put a recharge token on, when to remove one, and they're doing that seamlessly with the game, it actually makes things run very smoothly and quickly. That's been my experience.
I think I tend to agree with you there. I think on uneducated, they become cumbersome, but when you're comfortable with the system, they really do add to the flow.
Yeah, yeah, I think it flows really, really naturally once you've got everything down.
I would definitely suggest on your opening adventure or your opening session to definitely try to get that down, to explain to people how the basic mechanics work and how that they can use the chits and bits to their advantage, not to their hindrance.
So especially the dice.
Yeah.
I think the dice can really be used to your advantage and adding deeper role playing than you would than normally see.
For sure.
So one last question just for fun, because, you know, a lot of people ask it. It's a fun one to talk about. Every gamer wants to know, how do you get your girlfriend to play games with you?
Buy her a Tiffany's diamond ring and attach it to the box.
I just smile and ask her.
Yeah, so let's go for success stories first, and then we can go for the failures.
So, all right. So I'm slowly working on my girlfriend. I can successfully say that she's never been a gamer. But I got her to play Space Hulk. Of all games to play, she played Space Hulk.
Really?
Yeah. Nice. And so she's been reading my books, actually. Pretty funny. She just read, the Warhammer book. I don't know if she grabbed it when it was sitting on my bookshelf and started reading it and kind of gained some interest because she was asking when the next game was that we were going to play. And,
wow, Dan, she must really like you.
I think she does. She's a keeper, dude. But she's, you know, I think that if you introduce it in a dynamic way, you know, like Dungeons and Dragons, you know, it's pretty complex because the lineage of it goes back for so long. So this, though, I feel that it's a lot easier for her to relate to. I mean, it's not elves there are elves, but it has a different complexity to it. And she's found it pretty interesting. I mean, she's also, she also read my Death Watch book. So, I mean, she now knows more rules than I do. So now if I have questions, I could just go to her. So, but that's what she is. She just likes to read, but she's been gaining interest. She's also been reading my Warhammer books. And I think for her, the Warhammer books have kind of opened her eyes to this world. And, you know, she's seen my miniatures. So I think if you have a girlfriend that's more open to your gaming and understanding of these types of games, can possibly play. I mean, you know, Warhammer.
Lester, what about you've been gaming with your girlfriend for quite a while, right?
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. About a year ago, I got her interested into it. I'm pretty much like, batshit googly eye over role playing games. So I kind of slobber a lot and talk about them pretty much incessantly.
So before you go into that, I wanted to introduce one point that it's pretty safe to assume that, they probably have not played a game before or don't understand fully what the concept of this kind of gaming is. And that's a big hurdle for a lot of people to get over and educate somebody in a way that breaks the prior misconceptions. And I'm curious, you know, what did you do to kind of get that rolling?
Well, actually, the very first time she ever saw us role play, we were trying desperately to play a game of third edition Dungeons and Dragons. But I was having a serious D&D burnout from the D20 mechanic. I was just so sick of rolling one dice to decide everything, one dice to rule them all, you know? And she saw us playing, and she saw dynamics in it that she could have fun with, more so the social dynamics than necessarily the combat.
You're hitting on something really important there, which we should come back to when you're done.
Yeah, she really thought that seemed interesting, and I started to try to find, like, I took a break from role-playing for a few months, and I started to do some more research, and I've always loved Warhammer, and I found out that, you know, probably about 3 months or 4 months after they released the third edition, I found out about it, and I started to talk it up and do a bunch of research and tell her about it, and she really, really started to warm up to it and think it was great. And I have a ton of books from the actual Battles game. I don't have very many miniatures, but I have a ton of books, and I kind of read some of the stuff through to her and gave her some to look at, and she thought the artwork was great, and then she started to draw similarities to the real world, and she realized that role-playing can definitely be an opportunity to have fun. It's like a really good social experience. So
Mark,
we started
what about
playing just under a year ago. That's all right.
And Mark, you play and blog actively with your wife on your site. Do you guys play games together?
Yeah, actually she initially had no interest at all in gaming when we weren't actually together for most of our dating time because, I was in the Navy and we were separate. And then when we got married, we finally were in the same house together and I had all my role-playing game books and she had no interest whatsoever. So, I tried to introduce her to third edition D&D and that just fell flat on its face. She wanted no part in it. But when fourth edition came out, that's when, we just sort of started looking at it and she actually got really into it. She was able to really grok the mechanics and everything. And pretty much as soon as Warhammer Fantasy came out, she was right on board and gave it a try and really enjoyed the way that all the mechanics work. So, really it was just a matter of finding the game that she was interested in playing and the type of mechanics that she liked. And she actually, you said you were going to come back to the whole social stuff. She actually doesn't really care about any of the social stuff at all. She wants to kill. She just wants to kill stuff. So you try to get in a encounter where there's any type of talking with the characters, and she's more interested in killing the stuff and taking.
So I would argue that as a general rule of thumb, that's probably less common. And if the listeners out there are looking for a way to maybe engage someone more, is the social interactions, the problem solving and the investigation are probably going to be much more exciting, and then you can, you know, you sprinkle in the danger elsewhere as you play. But
oh yeah,
I think as we can illustrate, it's a different scenario for everybody, but possible. All right, and that about wraps
it up. I think Warhammer Fenda.
Oh,
yeah, I was just going to say that I think that this particular game lends itself to teaching new people the mechanics to find. I think the mechanics are really conducive to newer players. At least that's been my experience.
Oh yeah, and the great thing is that you can introduce small pieces of the rules. There's all the rules can be left out. You can leave out critical hits if you wanted to, and just have standard hits. You can leave out corruption. You can leave out mutations. You can leave out insanities, and then slowly introduce those rules. The nice
Absolutely.
Thing is the whole rule set is very, very modular in that sense.
I would certainly consider, I mean, it's really scary to look at these kind of games and see how many rules you need to understand to be able to play it, and the fact that you can strip out some of them is and ease somebody into what is a very intimidating system or game mechanic in general. I would highly encourage somebody to do that.
And I think the ability to have everything in front of you, not be referencing it continuously in a book, and it's all right there written out for you. You just read off the card to figure out what you need to do or what happens is a huge help as well for me.
And have a glass of
Definitely.
Wine while playing your first game. It helps, I promise. But here's one last fun bit for anybody who wants to maybe show somebody something that would get them into role playing is there's a show called Community. And an episode in this season completely focused on a game of Dungeons & Dragons where they really gave a lot of fun aspects to what role-playing is and how dorky and goofy and fun and very interesting it can be. And they did a brilliant job at it. I think it's episode 14 of season 2. So if you have a chance to look it up or find it, it was amazing. I watched it probably 3 or 4 times. I couldn't stop laughing. So if you enjoy role-playing games, absolutely watch it. And if you have somebody who you'd like to introduce to role-playing games who has no idea what they are, have them watch it and get to enjoy and laugh about it first.
That's an excellent show. They do a lot of things about those tropes, not just around RPGs, but that was an excellent and you know, it's on after The Office. I mean, that's pretty mainstream. So, you know, going back to that whole idea of how do I get my girlfriend into it? You know, my wife, not my girlfriend, you know, there's this whole law thing that goes in there, but, my girlfriend, I guess how I got her into gaming is that she already has geek tendencies and most women nowadays probably do. So how do you attach to that, right? Do they like cheesy vampire stuff? Do they like Harry Potter? Do they like, you know, there's somewhere in there, probably in their minds where they like stories. So it's not just reading the stories or watching the stories, but it's being able to participate in the story. And that's really what the role playing is all about.
Nicely put, Paul.
Yep.
Thank you.
That about wraps it up for our questions for this week.
Yep, yep, and we'll wrap it up for the episode as well. So we'll be back in 2 weeks with our next episode. Please do give us comments on our site, recklessdice.com.
And Facebook.
And Facebook. Send us an email at recklessdice. Follow us on Twitter. All of those sorts of things. Give us a review on iTunes. And also, Mark, thank you so much for sitting in with us tonight. Please, everybody, go check out dicemonkey.net, right? Is it a .net or a .com?
It's a .net, yep.
.net, yeah, I thought it was. Dicemonkey.net, and check out our friends over at the RPG Circus as well. If you wanna look at more general things about role-playing, all we talk about here is Warhammer and 3rd Edition. If you care about other stuff, too, and want to broaden your horizons, please do give them a listen as well. And thanks, everybody, for the show, and we'll catch you in another 2 weeks.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, guys.
Good night.